What if everything you thought you knew about giving, receiving, and consent is just the surface of something much deeper? In this revealing episode of Born to Know, we sit down with Dr. Betty Martin, creator of the Wheel of Consent, to explore the hidden dynamics of touch, boundaries, and the subtle ways we disconnect from ourselves and each other. Have you ever felt like you're always giving, yet rarely getting anything back? What if, in your effort to give, you were actually taking without even realizing it? This conversation uncovers how imbalance in relationships begins, often in the smallest, most unnoticed ways, starting in childhood, shaped by shame, politeness, and social expectations. Why don't most people know how to truly receive touch? Why does it make us so uncomfortable to receive, in general, even a simple compliment? What happens when we slow down, ask for what we want, and really listen to our bodies? She highlights the very sad truth that most people have no idea how to create intimacy or connection without the vehicle of intercourse, and what can be done to change that. Whether you're a parent, partner, or simply a human, this episode invites you to rethink safety, permission, and what authentic connection really feels like. Stick with us. This episode is life-changing. Betty, thank you so much for joining me on Born to Know. I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Great. Thanks for having me.
We're chatting earlier. I came across your work about 6 years ago, and it was very monumental for me. I was going through a rediscovery process at the time. I realized in working with a somatic experiencing expert, embodiment expert, her name's Whitney Lowry, it came into my awareness that there were parts of my body that were offline.
And yeah. you would not be the only one.
Right. So that was, you know, simultaneously frightening and also inspiring, because now I was meeting parts of myself, let's say, for the first time. And through that journey, I learned a lot about slowness. I realized where I was rushing through life and how much more rich life could be when I slowed down. And I also became painfully aware of certain experiences that I'd had in my life that were kind of being held in parts of my body that were, like I said, offline. So I would actually love to hear how you were inspired. What inspired you to develop the Wheel of Consent? And if you could give an overview of what that is before we jump in.
Yeah, well, I first want to say a little bit about your experience of starting to notice your body and different feelings and memories that would come up. And I don't know the science behind it, but I certainly have the clinical experience of it, that I was a chiropractor for 30 years and practiced a method called network chiropractic. And that happened. Yeah, that happened a lot. And I was also doing various kinds of self-exploration and therapeutic things. And I've had my hand in a lot of things. And there was a time when I started noticing this same thing. Oh, right, I have a body. Oh, right. And there's these memories that would come up, or these habits or patterns or feelings or responses that I become more aware of. And just moving a certain way would bring a certain awareness that I was not aware of. And so I definitely hear you there. And at some point in my mid-40s after divorce, I went to a number of workshops with the Body Electric School. And they are very physical, very hands-on. And one of the things that we did in one of the workshops, the first one I went to was for women, and that's where I learned that my Eros belongs to me. And the realization was so kind of sudden that it made me think, well, what was going on these previous 45 years, you know? And I realized that growing up in the 1950s, I thought that my sexuality was always in relationship to somebody else's. Like what somebody else thought was sexy, what somebody else wanted, what somebody else thought I should want or shouldn't want or should do or shouldn't do, you know. And when I came back to myself and claimed it for myself, it was a huge awakening and a big turning point for me to realize that, oh, wait a minute, this belongs to me. I can bring it out and play with it with whom and when and how and if I want to. And it doesn't depend on anybody else. I mean, I'm going to play with other people, but this feelings of arousal and eros and expression and movement, and that just depends on me being in touch with myself. And that was a huge, huge difference. So then at one of those mini workshops, we played a game called the 3-minute game. And that's a game for two people. And each person asks these two questions. You take turns. The two questions are, what do you want me to do to you for 3 minutes? Well, if you're asking me that question, I can think of some fun things I might want you to do to me for 3 minutes. And then I answer it and we negotiate and then we do it for 3 minutes. So that's one question. The other question is, what do you want to do to me for 3 minutes? And that's the one that for most people would kind of go, what does that even mean? And, you know, I would ask people that, what do you want to do to me for 3 minutes? And they would say, well, I'll do whatever you want. I say, well, that's very nice, but that's not the question. The question is, what do you want to do to me? And they would sometimes say, well, I want to do whatever is enjoyable to you. I said, that's great, but that's not the question. The question is, what do you want to do to me? And I found that most people had a hard time just having any concept of, oh, this is what I want to do. I want to play with your hair. I want to feel your legs. I want to sniff behind your ear. I want to, you know, hold your face in my hands. The things that we do to other people because we want to, it's a very important thing to be able to notice about yourself and communicate. But for most people, it was just like they couldn't even understand the question, or, you know, they couldn't go there. Or they would start, maybe they'd say, I want to play with your hair, and they'd put their hand in my hair, and then pretty soon they're giving me a scalp massage. You're like, no, that's for me. This is for you. Do what feels good to your hands. And so that turned out to be just a huge learning opportunity for most people. And then, sort of getting back to the learning through your body. And then what would often happen is that with both of these questions, people would have ahas about themselves that they hadn't noticed before. For example, I ask, what do you want to do to me? You say, I want to play with your hair, so you're playing with my hair. And then you have an aha of, oh my gosh, I feel so guilty. Why do I feel so guilty? You know, am I a bad person for being selfish? I loved to do this as a kid, but I was shamed for it and never got to do it. And all the blah, 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 blah. All kinds of stuff would come up. And the fact that it was bringing all this stuff up is what clued me into the fact that, oh, we're onto something here. Like we're tapping into something that's very fundamental. And indeed, when I started looking at it, taking action towards your own pleasure with somebody else, that's a very fundamental human desire and experience, but it's gotten pretty messed up because of the way we've been trained and treated. And I started asking, I was working as a sex coach at the time, so I started asking this question to my clients. My work was experiential, so it was touch based, and it wasn't just verbal coaching. So I would ask my clients, how do you want me to touch you? And how do you want to touch me? And all these confusions would come up, and their feelings would come up, and all this stuff would come up. And it showed us exactly where they were struggling. And so at some point I drew it out and wrote it down, because I realized, okay, two people, two questions, each person's asking two questions. That's going to be four rounds in the game. And in two of those rounds, I have my hands on you. In two of those rounds, you have your hands on me. Yeah, that makes sense. And in two of those rounds, it's about what I want. And in two of those rounds, it's about what you want. Okay. And they don't correlate. They cross like this. So then you end up with four quadrants, and they are: I do what you want, or I do what I want, or you do what you want, or you do what I want. And so they combine in four ways. The who is doing is a different factor than who it's for. And that's the basic aha of the wheel of consent. Because most people tend to think that if I'm touching you, then it's automatically assumed that it's for your benefit. And in most cases it is, but not always. I may be, if I'm feeling you up, who's that for? Well, that's for me. So distinguishing between those two dynamics is what happens when you play the 3-minute game, and the 3-minute game creates the wheel of consent, which is the four quadrants.
Well, I will put a link to your book, but it's either that or read the book. So I think that was perfect. And so much started firing off for me, because when I learned about the wheel of consent, I actually started practicing with myself, alone. If I'm doing this, to myself, this was my own experimentation, wasn't prompted necessarily by the book, but if I do this to my arm, am I doing this, for me, or am I doing it because I believe that this is what's supposed to feel good? So I simply started asking myself those types of questions. Very dangerous questions, because then you realize, like, you had that realization, what's been going on for a few decades. And so then I said, okay, well, my daughter's here. Let me ask, let's do this game together. And so I realized so much of my impulse to hug her or to kiss her was really from me, because it feels good to me to close that space with her. I actually started asking her, do you want to be hugged? And she'd either say yes or no, and didn't think much about it. Because I've been very conscious of never using shame or guilt as a manipulative tactic to get touch that I want.
Right.
So she was very easy for her to respond. And then I'd ask her, do you want a massage? And she likes to have her back scratched, and she was around 3 years old at the time. And, she asked for a back scratch. And then I'd say, you let me know whenever feels right for it to stop. mm-hmm. or you let me know you want me to keep going. And then mm-hmm. she'd let me know, oh, it's done. It doesn't feel good anymore. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
And she would tell me with her language.
Yeah.
And then I would stop and she'd say, thank you. And I would say, you're welcome. And so this is really how I started to understand. I realized that you know, we have all kinds of play partners, but really mine was with my daughter, who is mm-hmm. so clear mm-hmm. about what she wants and doesn't want. At the time she was 3, now she's much older, she's almost 10, but I got a taste mm-hmm. of what it is mm-hmm. to really hear someone negotiate with me without all of the years of you know, the suppressed trauma and the shame and the guilt and, you know, the people pleasing that so often happens.
Yeah.
Could you talk about, I mean, there's so many things, but could you talk about first what becomes available, let's say, with a man and a woman, for example, or a couple? What becomes available to them when they start understanding that consent and what it means to, like you said, negotiate touch?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
'Cause I do know I work with couples in my own way mm-hmm. in the birth and conception world, excuse me. And I've noticed that very often, you know, I teach them touch for labor and, you know, men want to know, or the partner wants to know, mm-hmm. what can I do? How do I do it? And she'll just say, you know, do it, like, do whatever you want, you know, he'll say, well, I don't know. Right. And then, you know, sometimes they've told me in confidence that, you know, they break down, the woman breaks down and says, you know, this is very triggering for me to do these physical exercises because I'm realizing the only time that my husband wants to connect and be intimate is when we have sex. And mm-hmm. now that he's having to touch me in a way that's just to support my sciatica or my comfort in labor, I'm realizing how starved I am for mm-hmm. touch that is not sexual.
Oh, yeah.
So totally. That's a big one. So yes, what becomes common. Available to couples when they start understanding this wheel of consent?
Well, the thing to know about the wheel of consent is it's a practice, just like yoga or anything else. It's something that you return to over time again and again. And there's fairly strict parameters. And you learn things about yourself, as you just noted. And then you take that learning back into your life and you do with it whatever you like. And so it's a practice. And I think that's important to know because it doesn't replace your life. It doesn't mean that every interaction in your life has to fit into the wheel. God forbid it doesn't, and it shouldn't. But because the wheel is really simplified, and life is not that simple. It doesn't fit it all those quadrants all the time. But what happens with you when you play with it over time? Well, let me back up a little bit. If you want to be sure to experience each of the 4 quadrants, and it works best to take it as a practice and be really strict about when I ask this, this is what I mean, and you know. You can also just play the game and not worry about any of that stuff. Just ask each other those 2 questions and see what happens, and you'll have some fun, probably. But as a practice, and you're learning about yourself, and you're having some wonderful experiences that you wouldn't have otherwise, what you discover is that, oh my gosh, there are things that I want. I didn't notice that before. And this will be true. Well, it's true of all genders, but it's kind of endemic in women, people who are raised as girls, because we're taught that when it comes to sex, our job is to keep the guy happy. And that's kind of it. You know, we don't really think. And so what you learn is that, oh, I actually do want to be held. Oh, I actually do want a foot rub. Oh, and it matters. Oh my gosh. What I want matters. Like that's a news for a lot of people. And then when I asked for it, it works. I got the foot rub I wanted. Holy shit, you know. So the whole thing can be kind of a revelation. So you learn that it worked. You learn how to notice what you want and that it works. You also learn that your no can be respected. When your partner asks, can I feel your legs? And you say, yeah, up to here. And then they do that and they respect your up to here. And you realize, holy shit, it worked. Like I said no, you know, from here on up. And that was respected. And that can be huge. And you learn that, oh my gosh, it's my responsibility to know my limits. And it's not their responsibility to guess them accurately. Holy shit, that'll throw the whole thing upside down, you know. So you start learning all these things. And what happens also is that your repertoire will naturally expand. And you'll discover, oh, I like having my back scratched just this way. Not this way, but just this way. Or, oh, I like being spanked. Or, oh, I like my toes being pulled. Or, I like my hair being pulled. Or, I like my ears being massaged. And you'll just discover all kinds of things that you had never thought of before. And the other thing that happens is that you start to distinguish between touch and sex. And that is huge for most people. Because touch is a human need that we're born with. Everybody, we never outgrow the need. And infants will show you this pretty well, and small children. We need to be touched not only for the physiology of just the fact that our nerve cells get stimulated, but also for the human connection and affection that it conveys. So we always need touch. Sex is a different need, completely different need. And even that need is not for the act of sex, or certainly not for intercourse, but it's the actual need is for sexual expression, which means being sexual in the way that's natural for us, which is going to be different than how it is for somebody else. So the expression of who I am as a sexual being is different than your need to express who you are as a sexual being. And so it does. The need for sex is not about intercourse, not about genitals. It's not even about being in the same room. I mean, you can clearly have sex on video or anything else. I mean, like, so it's not, yeah. And you can have sex without your genitals ever getting involved. So the need for touch is not about sex. For most people, when they do have sex, they want to also touch. Most people, most of the time. But the need for touch is not about sex at all. And the only way to those have become conflated for most people. And the only way to take them apart is to have some touch experiences that are not about sex. And then you discover what the difference is. But as long as the only time you touch is when you're having sex, which is sadly true for many people, then you're going to have those conflated. And that's a common tragedy in many heterosexual relationships, because little boys are taught not to touch and not to feel tender and not to cry and not to have soft feelings. And so anytime that they feel the need for touch or connection or comfort, they don't know how to get it because they've been taught not to. And so they go for sex. And so then sexual activity has to meet all these different needs, which it really wasn't designed to meet. And so, you know, you want comfort, you go for sex. You want recreation, you go for sex. You want connection, you go for sex. You want forgiveness, you go for sex. You know, you want to just rest in someone's arms who loves you, you go for sex, you know. And when you can actually meet those needs, if you want comfort, go for comfort. Forget the sex, just go for the comfort. And two different needs. And nothing will improve your sex life quite like learning that touch is something different, because then you learn to actually touch with some skill. And then your sex also becomes better. But yeah, they're two different things. Yeah.
And the conversations around what's going to go down and what's not going to go down. Right.
Yeah.
And so it's like going through that list of what I'm willing to do, what I'm neutral about, maybe willing to try, and what I am absolutely not willing to do. So this is something that I personally went through with someone, and it was pretty revolutionary for us. Because there were so many things that I assumed that person wanted. So I actually, because I wanted to, you know, provide a sense of pleasure for them, I was willing to go into my not willing to's. And sacrifice, or maybe in a sense be a martyr, so that they could have something that I was assuming they wanted. So then when they told me, I actually don't want that thing, I was like, is this how most people are? It's just like shooting around in the dark. Like, I assumed you wanted, so I'm doing it. But now that we've actually talked, I realize neither of us want the thing.
Happens all the time. All the time. Yeah. Well, you play with a 3-minute game for a while, that sort of stuff will stop. Because you'll start to notice, oh, wait, this actually works, this communication thing. It actually works.
Communication works. What a thought.
Yeah,
so
it's very common.
It's very common. And like you said, I mean, I know many couples as friends, as clients in the community, and it's very common what you said. I feel more so with men, because as young boys, there are not a lot of opportunities given for forming bonds and connections, either physically or even verbally or whatever it is. And so sex becomes the only opportunity for men to connect and meet a variety, a long list of needs. And so this could be where a lot of the breakdowns are happening, because some women, you know, for them, they want the eye contact. For them, that's connecting. For them, that's meeting a need, and it has nothing to do with, you know, penetration in 10 minutes. So
right.
But I think for many men, it's like, oh, we're making eye contact. That means penetration in 10 minutes.
That's right.
It's a, it's you know, speaking to how we grow up, you know, and what we can do. Maybe we have children or we're around children. What can we do so that they learn consent with touch, how to communicate those boundaries, those needs, those willing to's, not willing to's? For me personally, I perceive, not that we live in a violent world or that I'm always thinking about violence, but even wanting to your partner to be different than they are is a form of violence in a sense, because you're trying to peg them into something they didn't consent to being, which feels violent, right? Or a child doesn't want to kiss the relative that comes over to visit, and you know, we give them the look and they're being rude if they don't go and make body contact with someone they barely know, right? And so for me, that's a type of violence, because we're exerting power over someone against their consent. So there's this fine coercion, right? Where is this fine line? Because I've heard, I mean, I've heard, you know, it's maybe it's cultural, maybe it's many things, but I have heard adults say, you know, she's so rude, or he has no manners, right? And the child hears that and thinks, okay, this is the download I'm getting. In order to be polite, liked, be under the good graces of my parents, I have to self-betray mm-hmm. and forfeit my boundaries so that mm-hmm. I don't get looked down upon, you know?
Yeah.
So for me, this is one of the many ways in which we train children to shut down those parts. Yeah. Like I mentioned in yeah. the beginning of our chat, like I became aware of parts of myself that were offline. Mm-hmm. So this mm-hmm. is where we just start shutting parts down mm-hmm. in order to meet mm-hmm. the needs of those around us.
Mm-hmm.
So what yeah, can we do absolutely. To support the healthy development for children, the healthy development of identifying what we need, what we're not willing to do, what we are willing to do, and to hold those boundaries?
Well, first of all, you can believe them when they say no. It's not a simple thing to raise a child. I've raised three of them. They were born at home, by the way. You were talking about your doula work. And on the one hand, you want to respect their autonomy and so that they're learning that they do have a choice about how they're touched. And on the other hand, some things are not optional. We're going to change the diapers. I know you don't like it, but it's got to be done. So we're going to do it now. You communicate about it. We're going to brush your teeth. I know you don't like it. It's got to be done. We're going to brush your teeth. So on the one hand, you want to support their autonomy. And on the other hand, there are things that are not an option. And it's your responsibility to ensure that those things happen. And so how do you balance those two? And I think one thing that I've learned is that the things that are not an option can be communicated gently and firmly. Like, we are going to brush your teeth. I know you really don't like it, but I'm sorry, it's got to be done. We can do it now, or we can do it in a couple of minutes, or we can do it this way, or we can do it this way or something, but got to be done. And so that's one thing. And the other is that far fewer things are actually necessary than you might think. Wearing a jacket, going outside. Well, you might think it's necessary, but they may not actually need a jacket at all. Or they may get cold and come in and get it. Who cares? You know, like, are they so mentally disabled that they can't discern if they're cold? You know, like, and what if they get cold? Is that actually a problem? You know? So probably things that you might consider not optional may actually be optional if you look at it differently. But still, there are things that are not optional and they're going to happen. And so when it comes to kissing grandma when she comes over, I would call that optional. You don't have to kiss anybody you don't want to kiss. And other people's families and cultures would consider that not optional. I can't make that determination for you. But I think one thing that can help is noticing that there's a difference between those two and making that clear. The other thing is you can actually play the 3-minute game with your kids with a little adaptation. And this is the adaptation. You're asking them what they want. What do you want to do to me? What do you want me to do to you? But they are not asking what you want because of the big power imbalance. So what do you want to do to me for 3 minutes? And then, they want to climb on you, or they want to bang you with pillows, or, you know, chances are they're going to want a roughhouse, which is great if you can do it. And as long as they win, roughhouse all you want. As long as you have to make sure that they win. Never physically overpower a child. Unless it's for their immediate safety, you're picking them up from oncoming traffic, you know. So you can play that. How do you want me to, what do you want me to do to you? What do you want to do to me? And you can also model, you're saying yes and no. You can hit me with a pillow, yes, but not my head. Or yes, you can spank me on the bottom, but not the back. Or you can, you know, you can play with my feet, but don't bite them or whatever. So, or you, or you know, I'm not comfortable doing that, to choose something else. So you can also serve as an example of saying, no, that doesn't work for me, but we can do something else. So you're asking them what they want. They don't ask you what you want.
Yeah, it's fascinating how learning this, I started to become so aware of dynamics where mm-hmm. I used to perceive someone as actually, I used to think they were very giving. Mm-hmm. And after learning more about the wheel of consent and practicing it in my life, I started to notice there's one, you know, person in particular that I started realizing everything they were giving was actually for them to feel mm-hmm. safe and comfortable in the situation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I noticed this when one time I said, that actually doesn't feel great. And they thought they were being really generous with something. I said, that actually doesn't feel great for me. Could you stop? And then they stopped and then they kept doing it. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, but kind of in a different way. And I said, oh, this is because the whole time it's actually been for them. They weren't really mm-hmm, tuned mm-hmm. in, tapped in, turned on to what mm-hmm. I yeah. was saying. And yeah. then I realized it's almost like I'm not even talking.
Yeah. Yeah. That we do that all the time. I think it's pretty universal that we have to keep ourselves safe. Right. I mean, we're mammals. We have to keep ourselves safe. And so one of the ways that we have learned to do that as kids is to keep everybody else happy. Uh-huh. And yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty universal.
I do know that about this person in particular, that it was really their job growing up to mm-hmm. kind of hold everyone's emotions and make mm-hmm. sure everyone was tended to before they were.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's this interesting combination of resentment and also mm-hmm. infinite service to the other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, yeah. And so what would you say to women?
They need the 3-minute game.
They need the 3-minute game.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Because
we
when it's your turn,
we all need the 3-minute game.
We all need the 3-minute game. Because when it's your turn to receive what you want, there's no backing out. You got your 3 minutes, baby. And I didn't invent the game, but one of the nice things about it being short is that you may not really quite be able to handle an hour of luscious pleasure, but for 3 minutes, most people can kind of, you know, handle that and drink it in. When it's your turn to receive what you want, you don't get to give. It's just for you. Yeah.
Right. And as you do this, you expand your capacity to maybe then later receive mm-hmm. for 5 minutes.
Yes. Yeah.
And then receive for 10. And
yeah, absolutely.
And it grows and it grows. One thing I have heard a lot of is, and you touched on this a bit, but just kind of coming back, is I'm the adult and they're the child, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for me, there's such a lack of mutual respect in that mm-hmm. statement, because just because the, you know, the human is smaller and has, you know, less time on earth, let's say physically, we create this hierarchy. And that's part of what I think really feeds into that kind of coercive behavior, because what I notice is that when a child was really overpowered in that way, they either become the people pleaser or the pushover, or they become mm-hmm. the one who dominates, controls, and manipulates. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like these two extremes that happen. So have you seen in your practice over time that becoming aware of these principles can soften that, can help kind of equalize and create more mutual respect? when people come up against those boundaries, let's say?
Yeah. When you learn that when someone says no, that means a no, you don't argue with it. You learn that you can ask for what you want. You learn that they can say yes and no. A lot of things soften. It sounds like for you, it carries this, I'm the boss and you can do what I say, which that's one way to approach it. But I don't think it's inherent in being an adult and a child. I think I'm the adult, you're the child, can also mean I'm here to protect you.
Yeah.
And you can count on that. Which is not hierarchy. It's different roles that we have by the nature of our relationship and the nature of our skills and capacities. There are things that my child is not capable of deciding, but I am.
Right.
And it's my responsibility to make those decisions for the child. Now, there are some decisions that I don't need to make for the child, like do they want to kiss their grandmother? And of course, as the child gets older and gains in capacity, I'm making fewer and fewer decisions, and they're making more and more decisions. That's a gradual thing. But I don't think there is a power difference, of course, but I see it more as a responsibility difference. I have responsibilities as the adult that you don't have. Thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of those responsibilities is to keep you safe as much as I can from some things. And so I don't necessarily see it as a hierarchy.
Right. Yeah. I don't either. I experienced that. I mean, I've heard that phrase in different iterations, you know, in different settings, and it always kind of puzzled me, you know, and I see it as a bid for control, you know, when someone feels out of control as an adult. And, you know, perhaps they were told that, right? It's like we see this with food. It's like you're going to eat this and you're not getting up from the table until it's done because there's people in this other part of the world starving. And the child is so confused because they're saying like, I've actually heard that response where it's like, well, what can we do to help them? You know, it's like, but the child is saying like, I'm full, I'm not hungry anymore. You gave me too much food, you know, but this adult, right, the adult, and I put that in air quotes for those of you listening in the room, is basically just regurgitating something that they experienced, their own parents, you know, bid for control, right? And the only way when we feel out of control as an adult, if we don't have, you know, a sense of our own nervous system, is to exercise the control over someone who we perceive as powerless.
Chuckle at the things I thought I could and should control in my children. It's just, that was, food was one of them. But yeah. Yeah, of course. And this old saying that when you become a parent, then your own parent's voice comes out of your mouth and it surprises you, you know, and yeah, right. I found that to be true because that's how we learn, you know, and then we spend all these years in learning how to do something differently. And chances are we go so overboard the other way that then our children are now they're handicapped by the fact that we were too permissive. And then so we're not permissive enough or blah, blah, blah. You know, a friend told me one time, which I really appreciated, and he happened to be a family and child therapist. My kids were middle-sized teenagers. He said, you don't actually have to be a good parent. You just have to be good enough. I was like, oh my gosh, that's such a relief. Like, I somehow thought that I could figure out how to be the perfect parent. Oh my gosh.
Right.
Oh, Yeah, no, I couldn't. I didn't. And yeah, I don't know that anybody is.
No, I feel so good to get that permission.
We're learning as we go, and we're going to fuck up, and our children are going to pay the price. And we paid the price for some of our parents' stuff. And it's just, you don't have to be a perfect parent. You just have to be good enough to not beat them and keep them alive as best you can. And, you know.
Right.
Yeah. And even that's not going to always work.
No. And like you said, there's these really kind of drastic pendulum swings that happen where, you know, you had a very oppressive parent, for example, and so then you become super permissive with your child. And what we don't actually realize is that children thrive when there are boundaries and there is that containment, you know, that they actually want to know that there's a limit, because when they see that limit or they feel that limit, then they can go wild and play within those limits. But when they don't feel a limit, they might take less chances, actually, and they might not want to go that far from the nest, let's say. So it's very important to actually create that container. What would you say becomes available, let's just say, you know, for women and men? What becomes available to them when they can expand their permission field? Because you've mentioned it a few times in situations, even with children, where, you know, okay, you want to go outside, you don't want to wear your jacket, you get to choose, right? That's a big permission field to give a child, is to have that choice, or, you know, to ask somebody to choose how they want to be touched. This might be the first time they've ever been given that permission field. And for me, one of the big things that gets to be relieved is the burden of shame, you know, which is a very kind of low frequency to feel, you know. We all have experienced a dimension of it, you know, and for me, it's very much a control tactic that's perpetuated in different circles to make sure that things stay under control. And so what becomes available to people, anybody in their life, when this permission field is expanded?
That's a great question. I tell you what a lot of people have told me is that a really central part of playing the 3-minute game in the Wheel of Consent is slowing down enough to notice what you actually want and what you don't want. And that comes pretty much from a somatic experience, what does it feel like in my body when I'm a no? Oh, it feels tight right here. Or, oh, it feels hot right here. What does it feel like when I feel like a yes? Oh, I feel an open in this chest, or I feel a soft in my belly, whatever it is. People get much better at noticing those inner signals of yes, no, maybe, sort of, how would this fit? So they get better at noticing those, and they start to trust them more. And that is not always an easy path, because now you find yourself sitting across from this friend who you thought was a really good friend, and they're going on and on and on and on, and you're noticing, I don't like this. Like, what am I sitting here for? And you realize that you don't really want to be there. And now you have to decide, am I going to sit through it? Am I going to leave? Am I going to change the subject? Am I going to tell my friend how I feel? Like, now what?
Right. Because you can't unsee it.
Now
you
have
to unfeel it.
That's right. Can't unfeel it. That's right. And, or maybe it's with a spouse and you realize that you have been putting up with something that is not useful or helpful or healthy or safe for you, and you go, oh shit, now what? Do I confront it? Do I leave? Do I insist on therapy? What now? Or at work, you know, you have a boss that's been abusive, or just doesn't, or you have never said no, so they have never had any reason to think that you would say no. And so they're right. asking you to do all kinds of stuff. And if you just said no, they'd be fine. But you've never said no. So how are they going to know that? It could be the same with your friend or your husband as well, your husband, your partner, your spouse. So, one person said, you know, I have thought for years that my husband was just selfish. And what I realized is that I was giving it all away. He wasn't taking it. Right. I was just giving it away. And that was a big aha for her. So as you become more aware of what your body's saying to you, your yeses and nos, and you become, then you'll put on these glasses, and then you can't not see it, like you said. And then you'll start to see where it's happening in your relationships with your friends and neighbors and family.
I noticed where it was happening in relationship to myself, how many things I was doing on a daily basis that were actually a no in my body. And I was like, oh, perhaps this is the key to understanding the chronic exhaustion, is because I'm doing this thing that actually I believe it's actually for everyone else, so that I fit into this certain role. And, you know, there's a whole story there, but you can't unsee it. And then the thing becomes it's so loud in your body. And when I've talked to people about this, they say, oh, but it's so selfish. You can't just go through life doing the things that only you want to do. And I say, okay, I understand that, but there has to be a way in which the things that we do, we can up the pleasure, or we can connect to it in a different way, right? So it's like, if you don't enjoy going to the grocery store, but it's part of your, you know, role or task in the home, you know, for everything to function properly, how do you do it at a time of the day that feels better? How do you do it, you know, maybe wearing something in particular that feels better? Perhaps you put on headphones and listen to music. What are the things that you can do to actually up the pleasure and the ease of the experience so that it becomes a willing to, and your body starts to, I wouldn't say you're tricking your body, I'd say you're just making accommodations to make it feel good if it's a necessary part of daily life, right? So yeah. A lot does become.
Yeah, we've talked in this conversation a lot about the receiving half, but there's things to learn about the giving half of the wheel as well. And when I'm giving a gift, I'm either letting you do what you want, or I'm doing what you want. I'm taking what I want and I put it on the shelf temporarily, not forever, temporarily. And I am responsible for noticing and trusting and valuing my limit. I'm willing to give you this. I'm not willing to give you this. I can give you this for 20 minutes. I can't do it for an hour. I can do it for 20 minutes. Or I can do this for you on Thursday. I can't do it today. Or you can do this to me if you want, but I'm going to keep my clothes on or whatever. So. Mm-hmm. When we take responsibility for the limits to what we can give, then giving becomes a joy, because it's naturally satisfying to give to other people and contribute to their enjoyment. It's naturally satisfying. Where it's a problem is where we ignore ourselves and go along with stuff and put up with stuff and do and give because we don't know what else to do. That's not satisfying. And so it turns out that learning that you have limits and that you can say no is the secret to actually being more generous. Because if you can't take any responsibility for your limits, or don't know that you get to have them, which is true of many people, then as soon as you do anything for anybody else, you're worried that they're going to ask for more and more and more, and you can't say no, and then you're stuck, and then you're up. You know, if I know, yeah, I can help you with that for 20 minutes, then for those 20 minutes, I'm perfectly happy and generous and giving this gift. And of course, in families, there are times when the situation demands that you give a lot, even if you don't feel like it. And that deserves, I mean, that's just unavoidable. You got to get in the middle of the night with a baby. That's all there is to it, you know. And so there are times when you might feel like you have to give a lot, of course. And
right.
When you have practices in which you learn how to set limits and say no, then you start to trust that, okay, I'm going to give a lot here, and I'm happy to do it because I'm choosing it. And yes, I'm going to do this for you. And that saves on a lot of resentment. Resentment will come up if you don't feel like you have a choice. Yeah. When you can actually make a choice, you don't need to be resentful.
Right. And it's interesting because this actually touches on transactional relationships, because I've worked in, you know, just as an observer. I'm not here to be a couples therapist when I'm counseling for pregnancy or anything like that, but I just observe dynamics. And I have heard, you know, partners say like, well, why would I do that if she doesn't do this? Or she's not picking up her weight around the house and I'm just expected to do this. And I start to hear a lot of echoes of what I consider to be very transactional relationships. And I think, well, you know, everyone's roles are different, you know, and what have you agreed upon? And women feel that there's a lot of invisible labor, and men feel, you know, let's just say in this specific type of dynamic. And so where does that transactional nature come from? I'll only do for you if I'm going to get something in return. Is that something that you have seen a lot? And what is, like, what's it a product of?
When both people learn that they can ask for what they want and the vulnerability that that engenders, they tend to develop more compassion for each other. I don't know why. It just seems to happen. And also when we actually receive those gifts of comfort and attention and pleasure and stuff, then that also engenders compassion and gratitude, and it just softens a lot of things up. And I would kind of wonder, if I was coaching a couple like that, I would want to go into where, if you feel like you're giving too much, if you feel like you're overgiving and you feel like your partner is forever taking something from you and just goes on and on, I would question your ability to say no. And once you develop that ability to say no, you will naturally, you'll naturally be able to say no. You'll naturally have notice that, oh, I can give you this much, but not this much. And when I'm giving you this much, then I'm happy and generous to do so. That I have noticed. Yeah. And.
Yeah, I've actually noticed that too.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And to be fair, there are relationships in which it is actually dangerous to say no.
Yeah.
And please get some help if that's the case.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you say dangerous, because for some people, it's not immediate physical danger, but it's actually maybe 3 days of stonewalling and silent treatment, which is incredibly psychologically dangerous. Wow, Betty, this has been an incredible conversation. I I just feel like I could keep exploring all of the nooks and crannies of the wheel of consent. We didn't get even into, you know, allowing and understanding what that means. So, of course, I'm going to share your resources and your content in the show notes. Yeah, and it's just been, these tools have been life-changing for me. I've woven them into my doula training and my childbirth educator training that I lead because when we just have that self-awareness of what it means for us to slow down, what becomes available when we start paying attention to that inner no and that inner yes, I have just found so much more open up for women who I work with. And we end up being able to give and receive from a fuller cup.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, so it's just the work you do is magical and powerful and so transformative.
Thank you. I'm glad you found it useful.